This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Whether it's droughts or big heat periods of heat, agriculture in Africa is going to be tougher in the future.
In Seattle, that's Bill Gates speaking with VOA's Leonard Moudou about Africa's challenges. Details coming up also. Tunisia's Electoral Commission today confirms law professor Kais Saied and media mogul Nabil Karoui won most votes in Sunday's presidential election. And Rwanda and Uganda have agreed to resolve issues that have strained bilateral relations. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, living conditions have improved greatly since 2000, even for the world's poorest people, but billions remain mired in layers of inequality. That is the assessment from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's report on progress towards United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. In Seattle, Gates spoke with VOA's Leonard Moudou about Africa's challenges in fighting climate change, improving education for girls, and making sure polio doesn't get a foothold on the continent again.
To what extent is it possible to stop climate change, or is adaptation the way of the future?
Well, we certainly need to do both. I wish I could tell you that the mitigation effort, that is reducing the greenhouse gases, would be so successful that we wouldn't have to worry about adaptation. But even in the best case, we will have over 2 degrees of warming. And so whether it's droughts or big heat periods of heat, agriculture in Africa is going to be tougher in the future than it is today. The seed research system in the world is underfunded, and yet if we fund it properly, we'll come up with seeds that are more productive and can deal with the heat or the flood or need less watering.
Now, speaking of education, the report shows also that the gender gap in education is closing, but will persist in sub-Saharan Africa for the foreseeable future. So how can this be addressed to improve future outcome in education for young girls?
Yeah, so Asia, by and large, eliminated the gender gap at both primary and secondary school. Within Africa, there are countries that do better on the gender gap than others. But I'd also highlight that the quality of the learning experience is still something we can do a lot. There are kids who are in school for long periods of time, and yet their ability to read sentences or do simple math is not very good. And so helping to train the teachers, making sure we're picking the teachers in the right way.
You've been a strong advocate of vaccination and also fighting to ensure that children don't have polio. This year, Nigeria marked a milestone, which is reaching 3 years without polio. Can I have your reaction to that? How does this make you feel?
Well, there's a lot of credit to go around. Nigeria engaged. The heroes are the women who went out, went house to house, even up in the northwest, northeast, at some risk to their lives in doing that. So it's a wondrous effort. We're not done. We have to get to zero cases, and we still have some vaccine-derived cases in Africa, and we still have some wild-type cases in Pakistan and Afghanistan. But here's another milestone where it's been 3 years since any wild polio cases have been seen in Africa. We worry that, you know, it could spread back into Africa.
Microsoft founder and philanthropist Bill Gates, he spoke with VOA's Leonard Moudou in Seattle. Two Tunisia's Electoral Commission today confirmed early vote counts and said law professor Kais Saied and media mogul Nabil Karoui won most votes in Sunday's presidential election. They defeated more than 20 rivals, many of them established political leaders, to advance to a second-round runoff. Lisa Bryant has been in Tunisia to cover the election for VOA. She spoke with Kate Pound-Dawson a short time ago.
Really free democratic presidential elections that Tunisia's had since independence. And it's important to note what it was like before. Before, you know, we had pretty much two presidents for life. And it's coming within a context that's very unusual right now. First, the elections were moved up because the president who was there, Abidji Saïd Essebsi, he died. He died, rather suddenly, and the legislative elections, which were super important in Tunisia, were supposed to be in October, and then the presidential. So now we have the presidentials, the first round at least, that came first. Secondly, the way these elections have come out, I mean, it's coming within a backdrop of a struggling economy, high unemployment, high youth unemployment, and this is being widely seen with these results, initial results, as a sanction vote against the establishment, against the, you know, the tough austerity policies.
Now, tell us a little bit about the two candidates who are seen as the big leaders so far in the first round.
So we have Kais Saied, who is, you know, a professor, a law professor. He's run a sort of a very low-level campaign. He's also shunned these large rallies that other people have been holding, and he's gone door to door. However, he's not a political unknown for the Tunisians because he has been on the television screen since the revolution of 2011, sort of explaining constitutional processes, etc. He's a political conservative. He has defended the death penalty, criminalization of homosexuality, and a sexual assault law that punishes unmarried couples who are displaying affection publicly. So he is, you know, quite conservative. However, his big draw, people are saying this on the streets, is he's an honest man, and people are feeling that the system has betrayed them, and that there is extremely high corruption in Tunisia, not just you know, in political parties, but it's really pervasive. The second candidate is in some ways quite different from him. His name is now Nabil Karoui. He's a business tycoon. He's a media tycoon. But he's been in jail for tax evasion and money laundering allegations. So he has not also been campaigning in the field. His, you know, his supporters, his wife have been out stumping for him. But we haven't seen Nabil Karoui's face in this campaign either. He's also in a sense a political outsider, and he's not been, you know, in government, but he has been a founder of the last major ruling party.
Now, what comes next in the process? You said they still have not yet set the date for the runoff. So when do you, that happens later today possibly, and then what happens in the coming weeks?
So the coming weeks, we're first going to be seeing legislative elections, and there is a possibility that they're going to be holding the presidential elections along with the legislative vote. But let's start with, first there'll be the legislative elections. All eyes are on this legislative vote, and there are thousands of candidates running for that one as well. So we're going to be seeing how that all pans out, whether El Nahda, the religious party, does well, whether maybe the, you know, the governing parties do better than they fared for the presidentials. So that's a big question mark. And then, of course, the runoff vote will be another. Everybody has had their eyes on Tunisia since revolution. It kicked off the broader Arab Spring Revolution. Tunisia is considered the only success story to date. And so that's why these elections are so important. I mean, will Tunisia be able to continue on this democratic path?
There was journalist Lisa Bryant in Tunisia speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. What happens now to Robert Mugabe's family, which, unlike the late leader, is not well-loved by Zimbabweans? The ruling party has recently revealed that it owns the family's home, a move widely seen as pressuring family members who have been speaking out against the leadership and resisting the government's wishes for Mugabe's burial. Former First Lady Grace Mugabe faces a litany of political and legal challenges. The tension has become evident as the family and government argue over the fate of Mugabe's body. VOA's Anita Powell explores this complex tale of power, personalities, and politics from Harare.
Weeping, she followed his casket, her footsteps heavy, her body draped in black lace. In public, Grace Mugabe has been the picture of the dignified, dutiful widow since her husband, former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe, died earlier this month at the age of 95. But behind the scenes, it's a different matter, as salacious details leak out while the government and Mugabe family negotiate with increasing bitterness about the fate of the leader's body. It has become a battle going well beyond Grace Mugabe and her family to reach the highest levels of Zimbabwe's complicated struggle for power. Derek Matyshak, a Harare-based governance consultant, says the fulcrum was in 2017, as speculation grew that the ailing leader wanted to install his much younger wife in his place. Amid this tension, Mugabe, allegedly under pressure from Grace, fired his deputy, Emmerson Mnangagwa. 3 weeks later, Mnangagwa used the military to pressure Mugabe to resign. Throughout, Matyshak says, it was critical for Mnangagwa to paint the power transition as a peaceful, voluntary one. Mugabe himself disputed that, calling it an outright coup, words that have hurt Mnangagwa's legitimacy. But now that Mugabe is dead, Matyshak says, the gloves are off between him and Grace Mugabe.
She's in a very weakened position from how she was before Mugabe's death. It was very expedient for Mnangagwa to continue to extol Mugabe as a liberation icon. So Mnangagwa has been at pains to say that all is well between him and Mugabe and to try and present that face to the world and to the regional leaders. The problem has always been, of course, Grace Mugabe, because many people believe that it was because of Grace Mugabe that Mnangagwa was fired from office by Robert Mugabe, but out of deference to Mugabe and because of that expediency, Grace was largely left alone.
Although most of these conversations have occurred behind closed doors, tantalizing details have leaked out as the funeral plans have changed multiple times and the family appears to be resisting the government's wishes to bury Mugabe in the National Heroes Acre Cemetery. The state-run Herald newspaper this week reported that the ruling party owns Mugabe's Harare mansion, a revelation widely seen as an attempt by the ruling party to exert leverage on the family. The same day, the family called off plans to send the body to Mugabe's rural village, with no explanation. The family most recently said the burial would take place in 30 days, a move that could be seen as buying time. Grace Mugabe has few places to go. She faces arrest in South Africa for allegedly assaulting a South African model with an electrical extension cord in 2017. And she's under sanctions and travel bans from the European Union and the United States. Family member Leo Mugabe says her future is straightforward. He spoke to VOA on the sidelines of Mugabe's public viewing in Harare.
Well, she will settle here. She's Zimbabwean. She has no reason to go anywhere. She will be at her house. And I'm sure she will start to do her normal work that she always been doing before. You know, the farm, you know, the business.
But she also faces legal problems at home. And Zimbabwe's notoriously politicized judiciary means those may resurface, says Matyshak.
And there are charges relating to ivory smuggling, which are out there, and these things suddenly gain a new lease of life anytime the Mugabe's venture into politics. She certainly needs to keep a low profile, and I think she might find things here a little bit uncomfortable.
VOA requested an interview with Mrs. Mugabe, but the family did not respond to the request. Anita Powell, VOA News, Harare.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Rwanda and Uganda have agreed to resolve issues that have strained bilateral relations in recent months. Through an ad hoc commission, the two sides have been working through their differences in order to diffuse tensions. Eugene Wimana reports from Rwanda's capital, Kigali, on the peace talks.
The talks agreed on a memorandum of understanding that was signed in Angola 1 month ago to end the dispute that prompted both countries accuse the other of spying, political assassinations, and meddling. The tensions had also prompted Rwanda to close the border with its northern neighbor. At the meeting Monday, Olivier Nkurunziza, Minister of State within Rwanda's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, spoke of the long history between the two countries.
Rwanda and Uganda, as Minister Kutesa said, share historical ties that should normally build a strong strategic alliance, given the long-standing bonds linking the two peoples and countries.
Rwanda's government, however, did not raise the issue of travel advisory aimed at discouraging Rwandans from traveling to Uganda. Kigali has voiced the concern about cases involving Rwandans who it says have been illegally detained or tortured on Ugandan soil. This has been a point of contention between the countries. Ugandan Foreign Affairs Minister Sam Kutesa says the state will employ due process in the case of the Rwandans.
We are going to use the courts. We are going to use all the formal ways of dealing with people who are alleged criminals or allegedly detained so that we distinguish the innocent from the guilty.
Rwanda also accuses Uganda of hosting and supporting terror groups aimed at destabilizing the government in Kigali. The Ugandan Foreign Affairs says his country has no interest in destabilizing Rwanda's security.
The point is that we have nothing to benefit in destabilizing Rwanda, just like I think we have nothing to benefit by destabilizing Uganda. We are going to be investigating all these allegations and counter-allegations, and we shall find a way of resolving them.
The ad hoc commission meeting was the first aimed at following up on the implementation of the Memorandum of Understanding. Angola's Minister of External Relations, Manuel Domingos Augusto, attended Monday's meeting. He voiced the optimism after the talks, saying it shows African countries can work together to resolve issues among themselves.
This is a very positive sign and is also a proof that we can find African solutions for African problems.
Rwanda and Uganda signed the Memorandum of Understanding on August 21st. Officials say that in addition to Angola, the Democratic Republic of Congo played a role in getting Rwanda and Uganda to sign the agreement. Despite the progress, though, observers say for now nothing has changed or improved and are taking a wait-and-see approach. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali.
A recent public opinion survey by Sky News shows that Sudanese citizens' top concerns for the new government are accountability for corruption and torture, breaking up militias, and addressing economic problems and domestic conflicts. France has offered $66 million to help Sudan's political transition and has promised to join European allies in calling on the U.S. government to drop Sudan from its list of state sponsors of terrorism. Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok will lead Sudan's delegation to the UN General Assembly to garner more international support for his transitional government. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shalawi spoke with Paul Nantulia, research associate at Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, about priorities for the transitional government and the need for international support.
There's a cause for optimism that with an independent body of this nature that is dominated by civil society members, that the new administration should then be able to move with reform priorities. It should also be recalled that the reformist elements do have significant executive power. They control the position of executive prime minister, control about half of the sovereign council, and 90% of the council of ministers. The two sides also agreed to launch an independent inquiry into the massacre that was conducted by troops belonging to the paramilitary rapid response forces that led to more than 100 civilian deaths. However, one should also be aware of the fact that in all peace agreements, the devil is always in the details. And there are three issues in particular that should give us some pause for thought. The first is that while the forces for freedom and change do dominate the Council of Ministers, the critical dockets of interior and defense will continue to be controlled by the military establishment. And the most influential leader in that structure is General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, the commander of the rapid support forces that are implicated in violence against civilians. It is likely that his allies will continue to resist reforms and attempt to limit the investigation into their conduct. And indeed, we have seen that some of the figures in the Forces for Freedom of Change have warned that this is only the beginning. And, you know, the hard work is actually going to come as the transition unfolds. So we're still not there. And, you know, the Sudanese society at large is also very mindful of similar events in Egypt, where you have a promising transition that is ultimately derailed and taken over by elements that want to entrench military rule. So I think these are some of the dangers on the horizon.
French Foreign Minister offered 60 million euros to assist transition in Sudan and promised to push with other European allies for removing Sudan from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. How significant is this for the post-revolution Sudan?
Well, I think the French initiative should be seen within the larger context of re-engagement by the international community. The African Union's swift action to readmit Sudan after expelling it shortly after the massacre of civilians. Now, external actors, including African countries, have been anxious to stabilize Sudan, given the continuing crisis in South Sudan and other areas. However, the evidence shows that for any transition to succeed, re-engagement by outside actors should be timed, sequenced, and calibrated towards supporting reform to ensure that the parties stick to their commitments in each phase of the transition. So I think the key lesson here is that external actors can either tip the scales and increase the momentum towards reform, which is going to be required in Sudan, or it can inadvertently enable and empower those whose political survival depends on retaining the status quo. So I think this is a key lesson that the international community should observe.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok will lead Sudan's delegation to the UN General Assembly. Will his participation in this event allow him to garner more international support for his transitional government?
It definitely will. The Sudanese reform movement is quite broad and it enjoys popular support on the continent. So I think it will definitely help generate some continental and international backing. Second, the international community is anxious to re-engage. The African Union has readmitted Sudan into the body, you know, and is pushing for the lifting of sanctions. So again, the fact that you have a prime minister that was selected by the civilian elements within the transition, visiting the United Nations General Assembly for the first time, is definitely going to create some momentum that could generate diplomatic support for the transition.
That was Paul Nantulia at Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Bill Androdi, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, migrants from Nigeria, Ethiopia, Zambia, and Kenya have been the target of personal attacks and their businesses have been looted. Xenophobia in South Africa on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.
Stand up!